followers start getting concerned about people telling things that they don't like to hear. So well done, the FCC. Keep going. I'm off to Beijing after this, where they have an FCC that doesn't have a clubhouse and isn't allowed to say things like this in public. So you know what you're missing. The title of my talk is, as some of you may have already recognized, is a sort of turning round of Sun Tzu's famous quote that the supreme art of warfare is to win without fighting. But if someone's going to win without fighting, then someone has to lose. And so the question is, the other players in the South China Sea disputes thinking about losing? I will quickly run through the presentation. There is a sort of way of looking at the South China Sea disputes which is becoming dominant, particularly in many American news outlets. And I won't be rude about the national interest because they've published an article of mine. But this is one such, China's 50,000 secret weapons in the South China Sea, arguing basically that China's fishing fleet, it has a strategic purpose, which is to force the other claimants and the United States out of the region. Well, kind of, but fishing boats have another purpose, which is to catch fish. And so the question is, which of these motivations is stronger when it comes to China's actions in the South China Sea? It's all taking place against a sort of background, I think, of pessimism in the United States about the future of its role as a world power. The graph you can see in the left-hand side is the Pew Surveys Index of Americans who think that China will eventually replace the United States as the world's leading superpower. And this year, 2014, the number is up to 39%. So there's a sense of pessimism back home in the United States that the US is on the way out and China is on the way up. And I want to see whether that is, borne out by the evidence. And this is kind of feeding into another narrative that China has an emerging, will be the emerging primal, the main power in Asia. And you see this in Robert Kaplan's book. You see it in any number of articles. And Hugh White has developed the argument in his book, The China Choice. And in that, in Hugh's recent comments, he argues that what's going on in the South China Sea is that China has deliberately tried to lure the United States into a series of confrontations by putting its allies and partners and friends through stress, trying to increase the pressure on the U.S. to support those allies, and eventually, by making the demands too great, try and fracture those relationships in order to force the United States to give up its leading role in East and Southeast Asia. I think that's far too complex an explanation. I think there's a much simpler explanation, mainly because if that was China's real aim, it's done an incredibly bad job of it. And as you can see from this little comparison, let's look at what happened China's position 5 years ago and compare it to where China is now. 5 years ago, there was a very pro-China government in the Philippines under Gloria Arroyo. The China-ASEAN free trade area was about to come into effect. China had just become Malaysia's largest trading partner. Vietnam relations were doing very well with demarcation of their land border just finished. And the US was in a financial crisis and wasn't really thinking about the outside world very much. 5 years on, everything has changed. You have an Aquino government in the Philippines, which is generally hostile to Beijing. We've had clashes with Vietnam at sea. Negotiations with the TPP are underway. We don't know how they'll conclude. But in Vietnam, the recent trouble with China has made people much more sympathetic to the idea of a trade deal with the United States. The stock market's at record levels. And compared to Obama's rather disastrous trip to China in November 2009, he returns to China in November 2014, much more confident, much more strong, much stronger strategic and financial position. And Southeast Asia is not being forced into welcoming the United States. It has been lobbying and begging the United States to remain engaged. If China had wanted to eject the United States from the region, it has done an incredibly bad job. Everything it has done over the past 5 years has been counterproductive. Why? I would argue that it's all to do with the way Beijing sees the region, sees its own problems and sees the region. We all know these basic facts about China. The workforce is aging and shrinking. It's highly dependent on imports of energy. This time last year, by some counts, became the world's largest energy importer. That makes it concerned about maritime supply routes. It's concerned about the security of its coastal cities. But above all, I think, or maybe not above all, but underlying it is this narrative that the Communist Party has ended the era of national humiliation. And through that, is achieving the territory, regaining territory, whether it be Macau and Hong Kong, or ultimately Taiwan, and in the middle, the South China Sea. So a quick diversion now into how China came to claim the South China Sea. The claim, as you will read in my book, is not ancient. The claim emerged in the first three decades of the 20th century. Admiral Cheng He did not go anywhere near any of the disputed islands in the South China Sea. If he did, he would have drowned because he would have been wrecked. The claim emerged as a result of nationalist agitation in the 1920s and 30s. I'll take just one example to make my point. This picture shows the official southernmost point of Chinese territory. Okay? It is an area of sea. Okay? There is nothing there. The nearest land is 22 meters below sea level. Okay? This area is called, or this place is called the James Shoal in English, known as the Zhengmu Ansha in Chinese. So how come in 1935 a Chinese government committee, an ROC government committee, named this as the southernmost point of Chinese territory? Well, the answer lies in a translation error. You won't be able to see this in great detail, but I'll be happy to share it with anybody who is interested. In 1933 to 1935, a Chinese government committee was tasked with giving Chinese names to all the features of the South China Sea. But at this time, China did not have the capacity to go and survey the islands. So what it did was take the existing British or international maps and either translate or transliterate the names. So, for example, in the Paracel Islands, there is an island called Jinyindao, which, excuse my pronunciation, is Money Island. But it's not money as in money, it's money as in William Taylor Money, who was the superintendent of the Bombay Marine, which was the navy of the East India Company, in the same way that Drummond Island and Pattle Island, which are the existing English names for those islands, they were also senior figures in the same organization. Another example in the Paracels, Linyang Island, Antelope Island. There are no antelopes there. It's named after the British ship, the Antelope, that surveyed it in the early 19th century. In the Spratlys, in Chinese, Beixian is simply the translation of North Danger, which is the English name for North Danger Reef. And Spratly Island was initially just transliterated as Sibalatuo. They simply took the English name and transliterated it. So James Shoal, the reason it's called Zhengmu is simply the transliteration of the English name James. It's not an ancient Chinese name. But how to translate shoal? Shoal, as you may be aware, is a word derived from Old English, which means shallow. But the Chinese committee didn't know that, so they translated it as tan, which means sandbank. And on this list, although you can't see it, in 1935 the name is given as Zhengmu Tan. And because they decided it was a sandbank, they decided it was land, and it therefore became Chinese territory, even though it didn't exist. The name was changed in 1947 to Zhengmu Ansha, which is a reef, which is a bit closer to what it actually is. So at its southernmost extreme, the U-shaped line is based on a feature that doesn't exist, and there are equal difficulties in other areas too. So please forget everything you've been told about this being an ancient and historic claim. It's the result of misunderstanding and mistranslation. It's also based on the idea of China's historic territory. And this is one example of the map making that was being done in the 1920s and 30s, a sense that China's territory had been shrunk by the foreigners and should rightfully be much greater. And you can see how this outer line includes territories as far as Afghanistan, Iran, the Andaman Islands, the Malay Peninsula, Sabah, the Sulu Sultanate, and Manchuria. So I can show you many other maps with exactly the same kind of lines around them. These were produced by private nationalist cartographers to educate the population. And eventually they transferred into the state sector. In the publication of a map in 1947, sorry, the lights are too great to really see. This is the copy of the map that was the successor to that 1947-48 map. And so there's ambiguity about what China's actual claim is in the South China Sea. Is it just claiming the islands and features with maritime zones drawn from them, or is it claiming the whole of the South China Sea inside this U-shaped line? And no one can be quite sure. In 2009, it submitted the ambiguity and the alarm increased because that was the deadline for countries to claim territory, claim an extended continental shelf with the UN Commission on the Limits of the Continental Shelf. And China submitted this map with the U-shaped line on it to that UN committee. And the first part of their statement, China has indisputable sovereignty over the islands and the adjacent waters. You may disagree with the sovereignty claim, but that's perfectly compatible with the law of the sea. The second part of the sentence is not compatible with the law of the sea, jurisdiction over the relevant waters, sea-attached map, which seems to imply a territorial claim on the whole South China Sea inside the U-shaped line. Since then, the foreign ministry has slightly rowed back from it. In 2011, it restated the claim in almost the same words, but removed the bit about sea-attached map. So it seems the Chinese foreign ministry has realized that what it's saying is not compatible with the law of the sea and has changed policy. The issue is, what does the foreign ministry know? One estimate of the foreign ministry's relative power in Chinese decision-making structures, which was a report published by the International Crisis Group in 2012, quoted a Beijing-based academic, a mainland scholar, Chinese national, ranking the foreign ministry somewhere between 40th and 50th in China's policy-making hierarchy. At the same time, other bits of the Chinese state are saying quite different things. So, for example, CNOOC, the Chinese national offshore oil company, 2 years ago issued exploration licenses for blocks of seabed off the Vietnamese coast. And you can see quite clearly that these blocks follow the shape of the U-shaped line. This is not about measuring maritime zones from islands. This is an assertion that CNOOC has the right to the seabed inside the U-shaped line. I'll happily share these slides with anybody afterwards who wants to look at them in more detail than you can see here. This is a map of a patrol that was carried out by the China Marine Surveillance, which has now been folded into the Coast Guards, which took place 2 years ago, and it was filmed for a television documentary. And Andrew Chubb, who has a fantastic blog called South Sea Conversations that I recommend, noted down every time he saw a map and worked out the position of the ship, and then came to this conclusion that it hadn't actually been visiting the islands, it had actually been patrolling the edge of the U-shaped line. So the China Coast Guard is acting as if the U-shaped line is in fact a national frontier. And the final example, Hainan Province, January of this year, it enacted, they came into force, its new fishing regulations, which uses the Nine Dash Line as a boundary. And if you can read the bottom bit, it even offers extra subsidies for fishing boats that are harassed by other countries whilst operating inside the Nine Dash Line. So there's an incentive. Go and fish in disputed waters and get an extra subsidy for your fishing boat. And I would argue that actually a lot of what we can see in the South China Sea is in fact driven by the internal and bureaucratic demands of various Chinese state agencies. I've called it in an article a political piñata. Whenever a branch of the state is looking for a bit of extra subsidy, all it has to do is go and bash the South China Sea issue, and a flow of goodies descends from Beijing, whether it be subsidies for increased fishing boat engine capacity, which Hainan has benefited greatly from, or budgets for the Navy or the Coast Guard, or exploration licenses for CNOOC. So this, in summary, is my argument that China is not engaged in the South China Sea purely to provoke a hegemonic struggle with the United States. It's primarily there as an end in itself to exploit the fish and the oil and that sort of thing. And it's mostly about a mixture of commercial and bureaucratic interests, you know, commercial opportunities and subsidies from the state. But they are based on a particular reading of history, which in my view is unsupported by the evidence, and there's more on that in the book, more on all of this in the book, in fact. And that we should not try to address the problem without addressing the symptoms, which is this skewed reading of history. Having said that, the one thing that most people come back at me at this point is that China's, the oil rig expedition that took place off the Paracel Islands in April, May, June this year, involved the fishing authorities, the Coast Guard, the Navy, the province, central government. It could not have been approved without very high-level authority. And I write from the Politburo. And I would agree that in that case, it's clear that that operation was centrally approved and directed, which, given that it backfired so spectacularly, makes you wonder about the quality of Chinese foreign policy making. No oil was drilled. All it did was antagonize the rest of the region. So what is going on? I think that the simplest explanation is that Chinese foreign policy making, frankly, isn't very good. It's about a lot of institutions that are pursuing their own interests without thinking what the long-term interests are of the state. And a slight little diversion, if you look into the detail of what happened with that oil rig, you would have expected that operation would have been run from the oil side by CNOOC, the offshore oil company that actually owns the oil rig, or a subsidiary of CNOOC owns the oil rig. It was not. CNOOC did not take part in that operation. It was actually CNPC that were running the oil drilling part of it. And at that time, CNPC was up to its neck in corruption allegations, allegations that eventually brought down the former interior minister in China. So my argument, I have no proof of this, this is simply my reading of the tea leaves, was that CNPC took part in this operation as a means of proving its political loyalty and trying to get some political cover in the face of all these corruption allegations. I can't prove it, it's just my theory. Southeast Asia wants the US to take sides in these territorial disputes. And I think that that would be a very dangerous thing for the US to do because there's a risk of escalation is far too great. There are two sets of disputes in the South China Sea. One is about which country owns which features. The other is a much more strategic global dispute about the rule of international law, access through the seas for military and commercial shipping, and the security of US allies. Those are things which I think the US would take very seriously. I don't think it should take very seriously the question of which reef belongs to which country. However, the two issues are colliding and overlapping increasingly, and that's a problem. Talking up the China threat, I think, will backfire on the United States because so many people in the US are weary of engagement and conflict that, in fact, it could have the opposite effect and just persuade an American public that it's better off just staying at home and not being engaged in Asia. A little brief thing, looking at the China threat, it's obviously a main theme of media discussions about what's happening in the South China Sea and the East China Sea, and I would argue that one needs to take a slightly more skeptical look at the abilities of the Chinese military. It has problems with corruption, with equipment, with training, with the quality of its recruits, all that kind of stuff. But we often hear bellicose comments from Chinese military media commentators. And I think it's worth having a little look at who these people are, who we often see, and actually thinking about why they say the things we do. So these are six of the best known of the Chinese hawks. And they often say things, very controversial things. So, for example, in August this year, when there was a very close flyby between an American surveillance jet and a Chinese fighter, the guy in the top left, Admiral Zhang Zhaozhong, said, "A knife at the throat is the only deterrence. From now on, we must fly even closer to the US surveillance aircraft." These people make plenty of similarly bellicose statements. The Air Force Colonel Dai Su on the right, he writes under a pseudonym Long Tao, And he, one of his quotes was, "When those oil platforms become towers of flame, who will be sorry then?" And they're regularly threatening Vietnam and the Philippines and the US and Japan with all kinds of calamity. But if you look at the biographies of all these people, they are all very closely linked with Chinese military intelligence. So, for example, in the bottom left, Luo Yuan, his father was Luo Qingchang, who was head of the Communist Party's Foreign Intelligence Agency until 1983. The lower middle guy, Yin Zhuo, he's the son of the PLA's political commissar, Yin Mingliang, and he's been given the title of Executive External Propaganda Expert by the Intelligence Department. And Zhu Chenghu on the right is the grandson of Marshal Zhu De, who was the founding commander-in-chief of the People's Liberation Army. Colonel Dai Su, although we haven't found a direct connection for him, but he works for something called the China Energy Fund Committee, which is headed by a guy called Ye Jianming, who is probably the son of a former director of military intelligence. So all of these people have direct personal connections to military intelligence. Therefore, they are performing a strategic role, I would argue. So, if you think any of the following thoughts, I suggest this is what you are supposed to think, and this is the role of these hawks in order to make you think this. So if you think that the Chinese government is under pressure from extreme nationalism, if you think that hardliners within the People's Liberation Army are pushing to take over state policy, or that there's a degree of irrationality in the PLA, that they might do something against the interests of the state, or that the CCP is a force for stability and in controlling these angry nationalists, or that it's probably better for the US and China to come to some kind of peace deal before it's too late. I would suggest these are deliberate messages that you are supposed to think that are being transmitted by people like this. And the problem is that people like me love a good bellicose statement, and we're ending up with a vicious howl round as hawks talk to hawks through the international media. And we are all to blame for that. But I don't think the Chinese leadership is mad. All options short of war, however, remain on the table. China's main interest, I would argue, is preserving what the Communist Party calls this period of strategic opportunity. There's some quotes there. So, my conclusions. The PRC's argument about history and historic claims is incorrect, but nonetheless we have to take it seriously because that's the foundation for their actions. Just focusing on security without addressing the history risks what I've called another Vietnam. What I mean by that is that when the US got engaged in the Vietnam War, it did so on the basis that it was defending South Vietnam against a country called North Vietnam. That wasn't how the Vietnamese saw it. They thought they were defending an independent Vietnam against a wrongful division by foreign powers. The US ended up fighting the wrong narrative for a long time and ended up losing. If you don't fight the right narrative in the South China Sea, the same thing could happen. And talking up the China threat without really weighing up its real meaning could be self-defeating in the long term. The end. Open. Feel free to challenge.
We'll open it up to questions from the floor. If you could just wait to be called upon, wait for the microphone to reach you, and please introduce yourself by name and affiliation. Here first, please, and then Philip.
Hi, I'm David Tweed from Bloomberg. We spoke the other day. Yeah. Can you just elaborate a bit on how you think that the United States should be responding then to this?
Good one. a lot of things. It shouldn't be forcing Southeast Asian countries to take sides. No Southeast Asian country is going to make a final choice between China and the US. So a kind of with us or against us approach is going to fail. Simple facts: China is ASEAN's largest trading partner. The US is ASEAN's largest investor. You know, it wants both to continue. What it's doing and what it will increasingly do is providing greater and greater support to the disputing countries to try and help them defend their claims. But it will do so in a way that is not obvious. Well, it's not directly or clearly compromising its neutrality on the final dispute. So, for example, last week, for the first time ever, there were three-way naval exercises involving the Philippines, the US, and for the first time, Japan. So it's obviously trying to bolster the Philippines' capacity. It's also trying to do what is called burden sharing, persuade other countries, Japan, Australia, India, perhaps South Korea, to take up part of the burden as well. Japan is selling Coast Guard ships to Vietnam and the Philippines. South Korea is selling jet fighters to the Philippines. India has just offered Navy ships to Vietnam. This is all part, I think, of a corralling effect. But the US should remain neutral. I don't think the disputes are going to be resolved anytime soon. I don't think the Chinese leadership has the ideological strength to basically say, oh yeah, we've been wrong about certain aspects of our historical education for the last 70 years. I think that would be very damaging to the party. Nonetheless, I think one has to keep plugging away at this. In some ways, you know, the status quo is not such a bad thing. Nobody is dying. No features are changing hands, really, with the exception, I suppose, of Scarborough Shoal in 2012 last year. There's been no threat to the freedom of commercial shipping or whatever. The threats are, in some ways, more ethereal. They are about which doctrine of international law you subscribe to, or whether the United States has the right to sail close to another country's coast. So I think trying to maintain the status quo, not get too agitated. I mean, the US Navy will take China's growing capabilities increasingly seriously. And I spoke at the US Naval War College last week, and I presented a version of this, and they came back to me and said, okay, you know, you may have a point about corruption and all the other things in the Chinese military, but nonetheless, they do produce a good anti-ship cruise missile. So you kind of have to, you know, the US has to be aware of China's growing capacity. Nonetheless, I think by stoking up alarm, I think they could end up, you know, making their lives harder. Remember all the talk about the Japan threat about 20 years ago. Where did that go?
Philip?
Philip Bowring, a columnist. You talk a lot about China and the United States. You don't talk at all about the 500 million people who live along the non-Chinese people who live along the South China Sea, and what they should do to confront the Chinese, because they have been confronted. You mentioned the Scarborough Shoal, which lies very, you know, close to the Philippine coast, which just was taken only last year by the Chinese. James Shoal lies merely 50 miles off the coast of Sarawak on the continental shelf, close to the Malaysian gas fields. Only in March this year, General Muldoko, the head of the Indonesian army, announced that Chinese claims now clearly encompassed the area off the Natuna Islands, which are rich in gas and which are part of Indonesian territorial waters. You say that the US should not get involved, and yet, you know, how can it not get involved when its friends and partners in Southeast Asia are threatened in this way, in ways which completely contradict the UN law of the sea in terms of continental shelf, for example. And in particular, I would mention continental shelf, because this is clearly an issue which Vietnam, Malaysia, and the Philippines all obviously have huge claims which contradict China's ridiculous historical nonsense, and Indonesia is close to doing that. Now we see that Indonesia, they've got a plan for, I think, 20 submarines by 2020 or 12 by 2016. Vietnam is buying 6, I think, from Aquila-class submarines from Russia. So there is a build-up, and these countries rightly feel that they should be doing something, and does this not mean that at some point, if China carries on behaving in the way it has been doing for the last 3 or 4 years, that they will have no choice except at some point to use those submarines to put to the bottom of the sea some of these Chinese vessels which attempt to drill for oil or which threaten the fishing boats of those countries.
Okay, good point. I'm only coming here because I've got a map up here which illustrates the Indonesia point. So for those of you who aren't, it's a bit hard to see, but the point is this illustrates Philip's point that an exclusive economic zone drawn from the Natuna Islands clearly overlaps with the nine-dash line defined by China. So Indonesia, although it pretends not to be involved in the disputes, is involved in the disputes, even though it doesn't claim any land features. Can we drop the light just to make that easy? Or can people see what I'm talking about? It's this bit. Kind of lozenge bit, which overlaps. So yeah, Indonesia is involved. In 1992, a couple of things happened. China gave a one-man American oil company called Crestone the rights to a block of seabed off the Vietnamese coast, which is very close to that that Indonesian overlap thing there. As a result, and then passed a law on the territorial sea. As a result, Indonesia bought one third of the East German Navy, and then organised massive military exercises and invited the Chinese to come and watch. And as a result, China hasn't done very much about Indonesia for about 20 years. But all of a sudden, it's getting more assertive, and has been. There was an incident when a Chinese ship threatened an Indonesian vessel that was attempting to stop Chinese fishermen fishing in the Indonesian exclusive economic zone. So I think Indonesia is finally waking up to the fact that it might have a problem. Interestingly, does anybody ever heard of a company called Bright Oil, which I think is listed on the Hong Kong Exchange? Anybody know anything about it? Right. I think you might hear a bit more of it coming in the next few months, possibly. That company I was talking about, Crestone, that had got the rights to that block of seabed, eventually sold it to another American company called Benton, which became Harvest Natural Resources. And in July this year, Harvest sold it. It's public information that they sold it for $3 million cash. But they won't tell me who they sold it to, but the word on the street is they sold it to this company, Bright Oil. And the other word on the street is that Bright Oil is a front for the PLA. So the PLA appears to have bought a block of seabed off the Vietnamese coast, which makes me think that that might be the place where China is going to put its next oil rig expedition. And as you can see, it's an awful long way down the Vietnamese coast, almost in Indonesian and Malaysian waters. And if they do this, this will be a major test. Are the Vietnamese going to try and obstruct them in some way? And if they're going to obstruct them, how? We saw what happened the last oil rig expedition, where basically Vietnam sent a bunch of wooden fishing boats to confront some very large metal Chinese Coast Guard ships with predictable results. The Vietnamese shipyards are busy trying to build bigger, more metal boats, and so we might end up with a kind of pushing and shoving competition. But what happens if they lose? Would they attempt to use something with more kinetic energy, as the Americans like to say? What should the United States do at that point? Should it send a guided missile cruiser to sink a Chinese oil rig? I think that would be a bad thing for the region in general. But it can obviously be a bit cleverer than that. It could organise multinational Coast Guard exercises to take place in the same bit of sea. It could train navies and other forces how to obstruct interventions in exclusive economic zones. But I think moving in as a military power to confront China in the South China Sea directly would be a bad thing for the region and ultimately counterproductive, I would argue. So I don't think there is, in answer to your point, I don't think there's a simple role for the US here, but I think it will require all of the US's skills in diplomacy, military assistance, civil assistance, all that kind of thing, in a way which is both obvious yet veiled at the same time.
I think if we can move along, we'll try and squeeze a couple more questions in, starting here.
Thanks very much. Brad Pepping from the Australian Consulate. First quick question, how unique is China's claim to sort of territorial waters well beyond the continental shelf? Is that entirely unprecedented, or is that other countries, have they done similar things? And the second quick question is, given the rising nationalism in China, given the strength of this narrative, what options does the party have if they did want a more compromised solution to, I guess, walk back from where they've put themselves?
I don't have an exhaustive knowledge of maritime law, but I think it is unprecedented. I mean, I have come across intelligent Chinese academics doing PhDs in University of Cambridge in England trying to find precedents for it. So they're looking for them, is the answer, and trying to stretch international law, other bits of international law, as far as they will go to find a rationale for this. Sorry, what was the second part? Well, I mean... I don't think it really wants to compromise, you know. It doesn't seem to be very interested in compromising. I think it sees a strategic interest in the South China Sea, and it will use whichever arguments, you know, give it some kind of cover. I don't think it likes to be seen as simply being a bully that's wandering around the neighbourhood saying, this is mine. But at the same time, so it's kind of inventing these kind of legal, you know, fig leaves for what it's doing, and it can at least say, look, we're justified, this is, you know, some spurious argument from international law. I mean, the Philippines is bringing a case against China at what's called the Permanent Court of Arbitration. If the court decides to hear it, it's my belief that the Philippines will win that case on every count. The reason is that when China occupied positions in the Spratlys in 1987-88, everything that was worth occupying had already been occupied, either by Taiwan or Vietnam, Philippines or Malaysia. So the only things that were left were things that were underwater at high tide. If they're underwater at high tide, you don't get any territorial sea, you don't get an exclusive economic zone. Therefore, the Philippines will win this case. But I think that explains why the Chinese are turning their low tide elevations, as they're called, into airstrips at the moment to try and basically say, well, we might have lost the legal case, but we're still here.
I'll just ask, if I may, in wrapping up. International scepticism, ridicule even, of the nine dash line rests on what you've described as an international rules-based system, certainly dating since the Second World War and helped to be brought about by US hegemony or US influence. I mean, to what extent are we seeing the birth pangs of a new order here where those international rules of the road no longer apply and we have to just get used to a new system that is imposed by a new hegemon?
Well, I think that's what the United States will fight about. I mean, if there's anything, I think that... I mean, that's why I think the South China Sea is important. It's not whether there are oil reserves there. It's who makes the rules that govern the world. That's why it's important. But unfortunately, that doesn't really fit very neatly into your average agency copy. Hence, our standard boilerplate of, you know, near to oil fields and international shipping lanes. But we don't talk about what really lies behind this, which is who gets the right to define the rules. And so, you know, UNCLOS, the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, was drawn up by all the countries of the world. PRC was fully involved in drawing those rules up. It can't claim that they're unfair inventions. However, they don't suit the current interests of Beijing. So therefore, Beijing is trying to stretch the rules and invent new ones. And for example, one could imagine, you know, if the Philippines decided that it was so desperate to develop the gas fields on the Reed Bank off Palawan Island that it might do a deal with Beijing to actually, you know, give it, in effect, sovereignty. That would be a major redrawing of the rules of the sea, in effect, because there is no global constitution. International law is what countries do, and if two countries set a precedent and they agree, then there's nothing, there's no court of appeal against that. So, you know, you can see how, you know, Chinese pressure might end up redefining the rules of the sea in a way that would have knock-on consequences for the rest of the world. And rather than having the freedom of the high seas to navigate, we could end up with a new regime whereby states can just claim bits of seabed on the basis of some vague historical title or whatever. And that would be, in my view, a bad thing.
Thank you very much, Bill. We're Very quickly, if we could, very quickly. One final question.
Yeah, Jing Chen from Forbes. I want to ask you whether do you see any sign that the civilian leaders in Beijing might be adopting a slightly different position from the military hawks?
Sorry, can you say that again?
I'm asking the civilian leaders in Beijing whether you see any sign that they might be adopting any slightly different position from the military.
On the military?
Is there any daylight between the civilians?
Oh, I see. I don't think anyone really knows. I mean, I think the Communist Party is opaque and has been so for a long time, and many people have thoughts on it. I mean, it may well be that the NSA is reading their emails and knows, but I don't think anybody else knows, and everyone else is just guessing, basically, I think. As far as I can tell, the military is firmly under party control, and that's the way they like it. And there will obviously be different points of view within the bureaucracy, but I would argue against this idea that there's a distinct lobby trying to drag, which is dragging the country in a particular direction. I think, you know, Communist Party policy is the result of Communist Party, you know, faction building and consensus building, factional fighting and consensus building. So, I think what we see is the result of lobbies within the party arguing a case and some kind of consensus being drawn, which I think in some ways is a bad sign, because it suggests that this isn't the actions of a maverick force, this is a consensus within the party. I mean, I think, you know, ultimately the only way that this problem can be ironed out is that whenever a Chinese spokesperson stands up and iterates the nine-dash line claim, everybody kind of looks down and shuffles their paper as if they've just said the Earth is flat, and then hopefully the kind of, you know, the general sense of embarrassment that somebody has kind of said this nonsense might start to permeate the minds of Beijing. For the cost of a few air-launched cruise missiles, we could have some very interesting historical seminars where people try to present their various historical evidence and see if it stands up to scrutiny or not. And it might, all of this stuff might help to chip away at this confident assertion. And the fact that, as far as I understand, every Chinese schoolchild learns in their first geography lesson that China has 3 million square kilometres of maritime territory, perhaps the Chinese government could make a commitment to changing the curriculum as a kind of small step in the right direction.
Thank you very much, Bill. It's been a very insightful and timely look at some of those issues that define relations in this part of the world for many years to come. Thank you. I'll just add, if you'd like to buy a copy of Bill's book, The South China Sea, The Struggle for Power in Asia, there are copies available at the front there. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. social problem.